From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're joined by the turntablist DJ Logic. On Christmas morning, 1986, a 14-year-old DJ Logic, then Jason Kibler, found a pair of turntables under the tree, a present given to him by his mom. Born and raised in the Bronx, young Jason knew all about the power and influence that simple turntables were beginning to have on music. He grew up at the same time and in the same Bronx neighborhoods as a burgeoning new art form called hip-hop music was breaking out to capture the ears of inner-city New York. He watched as Afrika Bambaataa, Kool Herc, and Grandmaster Flash turned the turntable from a simple machine used to play records into an unlikely instrument that, through scratching, cutting, and mixing, produced its own tech-age music. Over the last 15 years, DJ Logic has been taking his wheels of steel to the next level, out of the dance clubs, house parties, and park concerts, and on the stage, behind and sometimes in front of basses, guitars, keyboards, and drums. Despite his name, DJ Logic is a musician first, a DJ second. He's mixed it up with rock bands, hip-hop acts, and some of America's heaviest jazz musicians. Today, DJ Logic has his own group, Project Logic, with their second CD just out called The Anomaly. We caught up with him this week when he was up for the Boston Globe Jazz and Blues Festival. DJ Logic, welcome to On Point.
Yes, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Yes. You have taken the turntable and turned it into an instrument that sits in the middle of and sometimes in front of the band. Yes. That's an incredible migration for something that we just saw as an implement 20 years ago.
Yes.
What was the music that you grew up listening to that got you so focused as a young man keyed into music on the turntable?
Right. Well, I grew up listening to a lot of hip-hop. And just growing up listening to hip-hop, the turntables, the DJ was part of the whole hip-hop concept. You know, it was the DJ and the MC. And, you know, I would go out to different community centers in my neighborhood, hip-hop events, and I would see how the DJ was controlling the crowd with vinyl, and he was spinning, like, old funk records, old jazz records, and I was like, wow, I want to be able to do that, you know, and he was just mixing and blending, and that's what made it interesting for me, you know, to get into turntablism.
Did you have a sense, as a kid growing up in the Bronx, watching that music, listening to it, that you were in the midst of some kind of musical revolution, a hip-hop revolution, or was this just the sound of the neighborhood, period?
Yeah, you know, growing up young, you know, it was just like, it was like the sound that was coming out of the neighborhood, which I was just like, wow, this sounds cool, you know. And, you know, I also have a lot of culture around me in my neighborhood. And, you know, I was just like, hey, I want to do this. You know, this is amazing. You know, this is awesome, you know. So I just got, just like basketball, this was like the next hobby for me to jump into.
I want to ask you a personal question. It intersects with your music, but it's also about your family. When you were 14... Christmas came, and on Christmas morning, there for you were two beautiful turntables, a gift from your mother.
Yes.
Tell us about your mother, that she was that keyed into her 14-year-old son that she knew that two turntables would be just the thing for him.
Yeah, well, I used to listen to a lot of music around my house, and my mother as well. She used to play a lot of different types of music, from jazz to soul, Aretha Franklin, stuff like that, and Eddie Harris. And, you know, she saw how much I was into the music and taping from off the radio and stuff like that. And, you know, just like to keep me out of trouble and from running around in the streets, she just went out and, you know, it wasn't the expensive turntables.
Mm-hmm. It was like, what were they? Do you remember?
They were actually JVC turntables and you'd straight arm, you know, and I had a mixer that was donated from like one of my uncles. You know, it didn't have a cross fader at the time. It just had an up and down fader. And, you know, that's what I had to work with. And I got two crates and made my little table and, you know, called my friends over and we would just be jamming in my room, you know.
Jamming in your room. But that quickly took you out of your room and not onto the streets, but into the middle of the party scene.
That's
wherever people gathered, there was Jason Kibler, soon DJ Logic, mixing it up.
Yeah, that's it.
What was that scene?
it was special, you know, just getting all my friends and having friends come down and play with me and everybody just having a good time, just seeing everybody dance and vibe to what, you know, what I was spinning.
Tell us about how you moved from that scene into the underground jazz fusion scene in New York and the whole Knitting Factory scene. What were the steps? Who did you meet?
Oh, well, a friend of mine who lived in the next building from me, he was a drummer. His name was Richie Harrison.
And so this is rock and roll first, I guess.
Yeah, this is alternative rock and roll, I should say. And okay. This is the first time I exposed to that. You know, it was like a whole new thing, and I was young coming up. So from hip-hop into alternative rock and roll, it was like a whole new thing. And, you know, I was always into, like, learning new things and hearing new things, and that was one of the new things. And my drummer friend, Richie, he had a band called I and I, and we were signed to Sony Epic Records at the time, and we used to do a lot of gigs in the downtown scene at CBGB's as well as the Knitting Factory. Mm-hmm. And the band was also part of the Black Rock Coalition. We used to jam.
This is Vernon Reed.
Yeah, this
the
is
great
Vernon
guitarist
Reed. You guys, the great guitarist from Living Color. I used mm-hmm. to jam with him as well as with Living Color. Mm-hmm. And we used to throw in these events, and it just used to be all like Black Rock bands coming down. And
we're talking about 10 years ago or so now?
Yeah, like 10, 15 years mm-hmm. ago.
You're 30 now.
Yeah, you can say
that. I'm sorry, it happens.
Oops.
At that point, these were alternative guys who were not afraid to work the edge. But
right.
in their minds, was it working the edge to have turntables in the middle of the band? Was that something new? Did they think, oh, we didn't thought of that, but this guy can really work them. Let's bring him right in the middle.
Yeah, it was something new. And at the time, for me, I didn't really know it, you know, because for me, I was just having fun. And the musicians looked at me as a musician at that time. And, you know, I was looking at the musicians as a third turntable, just trying to find the right colors to blend to what they were doing and playing my role like a percussionist or a guitarist, you know, just like everybody else. And
I love that the musicians were the third turntable.
Yeah.
I mean, you're seeing the world in terms of turntables. It's not that the turntable was the odd instrument out, but they were the third turntable.
Yeah, just being logical at a young age, you know.
DJ Logic, give us the short course in how you make this sound happen. We know on your albums you've got all kinds of instrumentation around it. I loved when I opened your most recent album, The Anomaly.
Thank you.
And here you start off with a great cut called French Quarter.
Right.
And right away, I hear these horns that take me way back to Tower of Power. Just, they're really moving.
That's it.
But then, into the middle of all this comes the turntable, an instrument that when I was rocking to Tower of Power, you never would have heard. Got two beautiful turntables set up on the table in the studio here.
Yes.
You've got the mixer in the middle with all kinds of knobs and switches and buttons.
Yes,
over on the side, you've got, what did you call this? The chaos pad.
Yes, I call it the chaos pad, which caused a lot of chaos.
And this, you work your finger over that pad in the middle. Looks something like the ThinkPad pad on an IBM laptop.
Yes, yes.
And that's going to make havoc, make chaos.
Chaos as well as effects and stuff like that.
Can you walk us through a little bit and show us how you do your thing?
Yes, I'm going to do a little improv set. I've just been...
Are you actually going to use this album?
I'm going to use this album. I have an album from Berkeley that been very handy for me in my performances.
What makes it especially handy for you?
Just the variety of sounds that the guys at Berkeley put together, like horn sounds from sax to flute to trumpet to bass.
So before you stand up and start to do this, tell me, before you begin to work the turntables, mm-hmm. it's very important to you what vinyl is sitting on those turntables.
Yes, indeed. And I have another piece of vinyl that was just handed to me. It was a 13-year-old jazz sensation from France.
This is an impromptu challenge. One of our producers brought this in. It's in an ancient old album cover here. Mm-hmm. The 13-year-old jazz sensation from France, Boulou, with the Paris All-Stars. So you've never heard this before about five minutes ago.
Yeah, so.
But I watched you as you were kind of dipping into it, looking for. So you're looking for precise sounds that will work in a particular manipulation.
Yes, in a particular manipulation. And right now I'm going to show you. I'm just do a little horn solo on top of the groove.
Good, let's hear it. DJ Logic, working music from Berkeley, and just handed to him Boulou, the 13-year-old jazz sensation from France. There we have it, DJ Logic putting his turntable magic to work on top of an album that he just ran into for the first time about 5 minutes ago, Boulou, the 13-year-old jazz sensation from France, pulled up out of somebody's attic or basement, it looks like.
All improv.
All improv. When you first go through an album, a record, a vinyl album, what are you looking for? What makes interesting raw material for you?
There's a lot of different things. It could be ethnic sounds, vocals from like old blues records, old jazz records, different instrumentation, just like I did showing on horns and flutes and stuff like that, which I can manipulate. And if it's blending just right with the groove that I'm creating or that I'm performing with, you know, I look at it like that, you know, the right color.
When you set out to do that, this word color comes in a lot.
Yeah.
You're always looking to bring in new colors on top of the music. And I guess, do you see yourself as producing something new or showing us a new angle of something that's already been produced? How do you look at it, DJ Logic?
I'd say both, you know, like a new fusion, you know, a new fusion, new jazz, just a new style musically, and a lot of new different type of textures going on and different varieties and different angles.
Mm-hmm. We saw in his book, Hip Hop America, author Nelson George writes about the DJ's role in the development of Afro-American music culture.
Right.
And he says this interesting thing. He says, if it's about creating new notes, new chords, new harmonies, that's not what DJs do. But he said, if the tradition of DJing means embracing new sounds, bending found technology to the creator's will in search of new forms of rhythm made to inspire and please listeners, well then, sampling is as black as the blues. You know, he's attaching it to a legacy that comes right through jazz and blues and
that's
fusion.
It. That's right.
Do you feel yourself as part of that river, as the next stage in some kind of long flow of music?
Yes. Like you said, take back from the blues. You think about the washboard, you know, the acoustic scratch.
Yeah.
You know?
It's just an album stood on its end.
That's right, you know.
A little bigger grooves than yours.
Yes, you know. And, you know, I just look at all those different influences from all those different genres of music and continuing it on, you know.
We'll continue our interview with DJ Logic after a short break. Here's a cut from Project Logic's self-titled first CD called Bruckner Boulevard. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with turntablist DJ Logic. His group, called Project Logic, is now out with its second CD called The Anomaly. Here's a track called Drone. It's a collaboration between Logic and his fellow Black Rock Coalition member, the guitarist Vernon Reed. Era, I guess the guitar was a central instrument, and it had a kind of, and there's many ways you can describe what a guitar brings to it, but it's a kind of endlessly manipulable and almost sexual vibe that a guitar brings. When I listen to your album, I'm trying to describe in my mind what it is that the turntables add. Right. It's very contemporary sounding. It's this kind of zingy, very often frenetic, because it's high-pitched and it's quick. How would you describe what the turntable brings to whatever group of instruments it's part of?
Just brings a whole lot of different elements of texture and colors. Like going back to colors again, just being able to just like blend to what's going on around you. It's like playing a role as the percussionist or just like a guitarist, where just like you said, everything's going so fast, you know, but it's all in rhythm, you know, and it's all just locked in, synced in, and when you listen to the album, you're hearing the colors that's all locked into the groove and stuff like that, and, you know, that's basically how I just wanted to, like, blend, just like a guitarist would blend with the drums or the bass and stuff, et cetera.
Do you wear albums out quickly as you manipulate them?
Yes, I do.
You must have a huge collection that you go back to.
And, you know, more than one record, too, as well.
So if you find a record you like, you look for multiple copies of it because you know sooner or later you're going to wear it out.
Yeah, and if it's a good record that has a good source on it, you know, that I'm using a lot.
You must have quite a collection of vinyl at this point,
yes,
do you?
Yes, I do. A lot of jazz as well as hip-hop and world music. You know, I'm into a variety. I'm open.
Another cut on The Anomaly is entitled Black Buddha. Yes. It's described as trip-hop. Now, what's trip-hop?
Trip-hop is just like just broken up beats, you know, in different forms. You know, it doesn't stay in one groove. You know, it's a different transformation. You know, it goes from one groove to the next. And the beats are just like, you know,
like I can hear the way
it's a lot of offbeat stuff going.
That's right.
You know, you hear
it's not a steady beat. It's moving all the time.
Yeah, it's moving all the time, and there's a lot of offbeat stuff going because you hear the loop grooving, and you hear the live drums, and he's playing to the groove, and then we have at the chorus part, he's going into a drum and bass vibe, and groove is still flowing at the pace it started off, and then, you know, it's just taking it up to a whole nother element.
Listen to unmanipulated music these days and find it interesting? Or is music only interesting to DJ Logic when there's a turntablist who's working it?
Nah, I mean, I listen to the old music, you know, old jazz records and stuff like that. To me, that stuff was all manipulated, but even turntable, even tested.
Oh, now that's interesting. what do you mean exactly? I guess I kind of know, but say more.
You know, well, you look at some of the Miles' stuff, you know, like the 70s stuff. Some of that stuff, the fusion stuff, was manipulated in a way. There was a lot of textures and stuff going on, and the beats was, you know, they stayed in one groove, but then they changed. That's, I guess, some of my influences from the old stuff, too, you know, to be able to manipulate what I'm doing now, you know.
In 1996, you began experimenting with jazz in a really serious way.
Yes.
And got a big break. It put you on the musical map when you hooked up with the now famous trio, Medeski, Martin, and Wood.
Yes, wonderful group of guys.
Tell us about them and how you got linked up with them.
Just hanging around in the downtown scene. I used to play at the old Knitting Factory, which used to be on Broadway in Lafayette. And I used to sneak in there and do improvisational gigs with the jazz musicians there. And I met Billy Martin, the drummer from Medeski Martin Wood, and we just, you know, he dug what I was doing, how I was interacting with the drummer and stuff, and he was like, hey, why don't we try something? You know, he just wanted to try something different and new, and I was also well known in the scene, you know, just from playing with a lot of different musicians and contributing my skills to a lot of different musicians. And they had a Shaq release party for their Shaqman album, and they asked me to come down, as well as a couple other DJs. They were doing a whole experimental thing, and out of all the DJs, I was the one guy that fit right into what they were doing. You know, it was like the fourth member, they would say, and from that, that's when the Combustication album came about.
Must have been exciting.
It was awesome. You know, for them, it was even amazing. You know, just the different colors and different sounds I was coming out, the different textures and stuff that I was adding to what they were doing. And, like, you know, just the vibe on stage for me to go out on the road with them and for them to take me out on the road with them, the vibe was great.
They recognize right away that you brought the same passion to your non-traditional instrument as they brought to their traditional instruments.
Oh, yes. When we performed, it was just, like, beautiful. Just the different elements and textures that was going on around everybody. Everybody vibed off each other well. You know, we all looked at each other on the stage, and from the next song to the next, you know, there was no set list. You know, we just flowed into each song great.
Of course, jazz isn't the only area that this kind of hip-hop and turntablist approach touches. In many ways, it seems hip-hop is kind of tentacles that permeate, that they get into every genre. You see it from New Orleans jazz to hardcore rap. The DJ becomes an improviser who's having fun and making something new and different out of everything it touches. On The Anomaly, I thought Soul Kissing was just terrific.
Oh, thank you.
And there you've got an Eastern rhythm. You've got tabla in there, I think.
Yes, tabla, xylophone, vibraphone.
Violin, I think, is in there.
Violin, yes. Mary Benari, a wonderful Israeli violinist. And, you know, we just got together and talked about doing a track together.
Who's your conductor or your composer? How does a piece like Soul Kissing get put together?
Well, myself, as well as the producer who I had with me, his name is Melvin Gibbs, just his direction and musicianship.
So are you actually writing music for this, or are you talking about it and beginning to improvise and building?
I'm basically talking about it, what I want, and these different sounds that I'm hearing. You know, when I put down the track, I laid down the beat, and told Miss Mary Benari, you know, this is how I wanted to sound, and she came in and she wailed on it, and, you know, I just pieced it all together, and the next, you know, I called Brian Carrot, and I was hearing vibes, and he came in and he felt in love with the track, and he just said, he's like, oh, let me go home and get my African violophone and this and that. And
so I was just stacking, like, it up track by track.
Yeah, and then it all came into some sweet Soul Kissing.
Your band, Project Logic, a kind of workshop, and this has that sound to it. It's sort of doing it as you go.
That's right.
Did you know that Soul Kissing was going to have this Eastern sound, or did Mary just bring that to it and you built on it and brought in the tabla and went with it?
Yeah, Mary came in with it. She came in with the bass, and everything just built up right around her, around Mary. And back to the project, you look at it. Back in the days, you know, the jazz guys were going into the studio, and those were like projects, you know, they was doing records like, what, every month or so?
Right, just cranking them out.
Yeah, cranking them out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not cranking them out like that, but, you know, just the influence from you know, reading jazz books and stuff like that.
You're not afraid to be brave in the cut Hip Hopera.
Right.
Wow, you bring in this operatic voice.
Yes.
I was absolutely stunned to hear this as I went through the album. That is completely different sound, kind of haunting.
Yeah.
And, well, let's say a juxtaposition that we don't look for with hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so what is that, DJ Logic? Was that your inspiration? You said, I want to stretch it further. I want to get even an operatic sound in here. There's no place I won't take my turntable.
Yes, just like you said, not being afraid. And that was just taking it to a whole nother level. I've worked on projects like a Bach project with Ori Kane. And just from doing that project, I was influenced like, I want to do an opera, you know, I want to have an opera vocalist. And lo and behold, I had a vocalist in my neighborhood who I didn't know, and she was an opera singer, and I was just like, hey, why don't you come down and let's try to experiment. And
you got a rich neighborhood there. Reach out and you've got your opera singer.
That's it. Like Karis One says, the Bronx keeps creating.
Talking to DJ Logic, would you stand up and give us another demonstration of these turntables? Throw on some more records, take us somewhere else, and tell us where we're going.
Right. This is your basic hip-hop beat right here. Bring it back. And I have this opera voice here speaking on, you know, talking about opera.
Okay.
and I'm going to just do a little manipulation of the vocal on top of the
All
track.
Logic spins the discs. The vinyl is working here. Now, your Chaos Pad, would you bring it in with this, or is that for a different kind of beat or a different treatment?
Yes, I'll just bring the Chaos Pad in as well. You know, I'm going back and forth with the effect switch, so, you know.
You must have about 20 switches and knobs on the mixer in the center here.
Yeah, a whole lot of knobs, over just being like a mad scientist.
So that's the mixing. Now, are you doing scratching here, too, or not in this last bit?
Yes, this last bit I was doing scratching.
So the scratch is when you find a particular little tiny bit of sound. You're going back and forth
back
over
and
it.
Back and forth, and as well as moving the fader across.
Right, the fader, kinda, you're working like the guitar string.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, patting your head, rubbing your stomach.
Right.
You know, that's what I tell everybody. You
right.
can pat your head, rub your stomach, your scratch routine.
But bring some chaos into that for us so we can see what the famous Chaos Pad does.
Some of the chaos.
There it is. We're mixing it up with DJ Logic.
Yes.
We talked about Miles Davis earlier. You actually ended up working with the great Miles Davis producer, Teo Macero, for production of a song called Abyss.
Yes.
How did you connect with Teo? He's such a legend. And what did you learn?
Yes, it was beautiful working with Teo. And Teo is a wonderful, as you know, is a wonderful producer. And you know, wonderful man in general. I hooked up with Teo through Vernon Reed on Vernon's project, which was called Mistaken Identity, and it was Mask at the time, it was the name of the band as well. And just sitting down with Teo and talking, telling him how much, you know, I was influenced into, you know, Miles and everything, and hearing all
the foot of the master.
Yeah, and hearing all the stories and stuff like that, and he would just go on. Talking about all the different sessions he had with Miles, which I can't talk about. But you know, it was great.
And just how crazy it got.
Yeah, how
sometimes.
Crazy it got, and how many different sessions who he was working with. Mm-hmm.
What did you set out to do with Abyss?
With Abyss, you know, I wanted to kind of make it like a Miles type of feel, you know, and I didn't know Teal played trumpet at the time, and he's like, yeah, I'll play trumpet, you know, and I was like, okay, man, let's go in the studio and do a little something. You know, he's like, all right, you know, so.
He must be like 80 now?
Yeah, but he's still doing his thing, and he's putting out some good stuff and working on some good stuff.
He was at the heart of Bitches Brew, one of the more challenging Miles Davis albums.
Yes, indeed. And I had him come into the studio, and he played trumpet as well and helped produce the track, too.
Down some beautiful wisdom to you.
Yeah, you could say that. some beautiful wisdom and some beautiful logic as well. You know, we just hit off very well. And I love the man. The man is great.
You know, as I sit and talk to you, you're so obviously into the music, and you've got a kind of devotion to us, and I hope you don't take this wrong way, a kind of sweetness about it that we don't always associate with hip-hop, and especially off at the rap end of it.
Right.
But you're completely unabashed about that.
Right.
So here you are. You're sitting in the middle of this great universe of hip-hop, which has now got a huge celebrity gloss on it, you know, Strike the Pose and
bling bling and stuff. All that.
The tough guy, the gangster.
Yeah,
do you relate to that? Or what is your relationship with the celebrity edge of hip hop?
I mean, I don't really. I grew up listening to hip hop. It was all fun. It wasn't all about the bling bling and all of that. You know, that was just like what you saw on TV and stuff.
The violence, the sexual violence.
Yeah, and all that, you know. That's where I just got exposed to two different things. And, you know, I fell in love just playing with musicians as well as hip hop. You know, I still listen to hip hop, but I listen to certain different types of hip hop, not all the commercial stuff. I listen to a lot of underground hip hop that people wouldn't hear today.
Do you consider yourself a hip-hop artist?
I consider myself a musician, you know.
Wherever that goes.
Yeah, a musician as well as an artist.
When people look back 50 years from now,
right,
how do you think they'll associate the music that you've done through the Knitting Factory and right on up? Do you think they'll see it as part of the whole jazz sweep or as something that broke out into a new arena?
Something that probably broke out into a whole new arena, you know, just trying to bring something new to the table and expose something new to the table, you know, for the new generation, you know, century.
We'll continue our interview with DJ Logic after a short break. Let's go into it with a cut from Project Logic's self-titled CD, a tribute to Miles Davis called Kinda Blue. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with DJ Logic, who's a musician first and a DJ second. His group, Project Logic's new CD, is called The Anomaly. Here's a track from the CD called Miles Away, his tribute to one of his greatest influences, Miles Davis. DJ Logic, what do you think when you hear groups like Sugar Ray and Limp Bizkit bringing Turntable into their music as they did so much in the 90s? Is that just a natural outgrowth of of this coming up? Do you see it as a good thing, as an adventurous use, or just commercial groups cashing in on something? How do you see it?
Well, I'm a DJ, and I'm happy to see other DJs interacting with musicians. But, you know, it's just like I said, I've done it. I was in the Turner the Rock band at the time, like I said, and I started off DJing with a rock band, and people were just like feeling it at the time. But, you know, at the time for these cats to, you know, to be doing what they're doing, you know, I look back at it and like, wow, you know, that was me, you know, at that time. So I don't really like to put nobody down on their thing, but, you know, I'm happy to see that, you know, the interaction and stuff. And
Project Logic has a wonderful track, Eyes Open. And here you use a rapper.
Yes.
And also the theremin, which I think almost no one even knows what that is,
right.
But if you listen back to the old Hitchcock movies, it's there. Describe that theremin.
Well, the theremin is like an old instrument, like you said, and it vibes off of your hand, off the waveform. You don't have to touch the instrument. You just
is it
have
the electricity that is in your body that makes it move?
Yes, yes. You just put your hand a little bit, a couple feet away from the wand, and then just bring your hand back and forth and up and down till you know, you find a rhythm. I forgot the name of the lady that she's like one professional lady that she's supposed to be like real
the master of the theremin,
you know.
And there you brought that in along with a rapper. Now, this is different because recently you've been in the midst of a band.
Yes.
Now there you were with a rapper. Is it fun for you to go that way? Do you have as much freedom to improvise with a rapper as you do in the midst of a band?
Yes. I mean, you know, I talk to the rappers before I, you know, have them, you know, rap on the track. And usually, you know, I like to go back because I love hip-hop. So, you know, I go back to the roots of, you know, just a good friend of mine. His name is Beans, or Anti-Pop, I should say, Priest and Beans. They're wonderful rappers, and we worked with each other for a long time, and, you know, I had them come down and perform on the track, and they loved it. And I had also a friend named Christina Wheeler who played the theremin, and she was like, hey, y'all would love to come and sit on, you know, play on your track. And I was just like, oh, cool, it'd be a whole new instrument, new color to the whole project.
Circulatory tone, magnetic mode of attack. Deliver swarms of static, dynamic notation upon temples in turmoil. Flanks the listeners varying with unpredictable capacity of response may reveal my defiance and indifference. Still accelerating the rise of hope, ignoring you without a random glance. Once I take control of the vertical, you'll be the opposite of steady, not ready. Grip slippery like palm sweaty. Fingernail clipping nervous with the second growth bitter with each bite as a burden shed. Useless, taking up space, coming in third in a two-horse race. Stature diminished, isolated tremor, ideas encapsulated, verbal avenues to vent. No hidden motive, but meaning to defy the standard free of constraints. An altitude of soaring defiance evokes a path mounted on springs. Brought to you by Beans, once you take the time to reflect. Flex. You know what I'm talking about.
Look a ways out with this. Are you guessing that at some point turntables and this kind of technical manipulation and creation of music will be seen as a standard part of the musical instrumentation repertoire of American music?
Yeah, the way it's going, you know, there's a lot of other DJs coming out of the basement, you know, that I'm hearing about, you know, Kid Koala, DJ Radar, etc., Rob Swift, you know, it's a lot of different DJs interacting with musicians or orchestrating their own instrumentation, you know, improvisational way, I should say, on turntables.
It's terrific. Does your mother still follow your music?
Yes, she does.
is she proud of what she created with that gift of two turntables?
Yes, yes. She actually came out to one of my shows, and she just was overwhelmed. She didn't know how far I've gotten because, you know, every time I would just leave the house, Mom, I'm going to Europe, or I'm going to the Midwest. And she just thought it was just like, you know, something small. And when she came out and saw me, her and my twin sister, she was like, wow.
What is Jason up to?
Yeah.
He is DJ Logic, but you still, if I read correctly, live in just across the hall from where you grew up.
Yeah.
That's terrific. And when you've got all this music and opera singers as well within reach,
right.
why move?
You know, all the culture, all the sounds and textures going on around me, it's just a beautiful thing.
That's fantastic. DJ Logic, I want to thank you so much for coming in today. Your whole setup is beautiful. We love the music, and keep making it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
DJ Logic and Project Logic's new CD is called The Anomaly. Let's close the show with another track off The Anomaly called Beanie Man. If you'd like more information on DJ Logic, Project Logic, or this week's Boston Globe Jazz and Blues Festival, visit our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, I'll look back at the week's news with our news analyst, Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back on the sounds of the week.
Twenty people are dead, including the suicide bomber, 55 wounded, among them high school students and office workers riding on a bus at 8 a.m. this morning, the same bus which lay in flames moments after a 22-year-old Palestinian man detonated nail-packed explosives on board.
The fence we are building is not a border, nor does it separate between political entities or sovereign areas. We have set up the outline according to the best ability to prevent the infiltration of terrorists into Israeli territory.
We all the time denounce any operations against civilians, although if they are Palestinians or Israelis. But the Israeli government should ask itself about what they are doing today in Jenin and in Qalqilia, and their decision to reoccupy our land, our cities.
I think in the immediate aftermath of these attacks, it's obvious that the immediate aftermath is not the right time. The president knows what he wants to say. The president will share it when the president believes the time is right to share it so it can do the most good.
It now looks like the woman who has admitted to starting the Haman fire southwest of Denver may have started the fire intentionally to create a wildfire that she would then put out to look like a hero.
I am not seeking re-election again. I had come to the decision a while ago, and so I'm not going to seek re-election. I'm going back into the private sector. I will always protect my family first.
Securing our homeland is going to require more than the creation of a new agency. Yet there is no question that we must establish an entity that is singularly devoted to that purpose.
Endeavor, will stop.
Copy, will stop, Endeavor. Welcome back to Earth.
He loved his profession, loved St. Louis, and he loved the St. Louis Cardinals. We'll miss him greatly, and Jack, your fans and I, we all love you.
The sounds of a week, more suicide bombings in Jerusalem, talk of a fence and beginning of construction between Israelis and Palestinians, Palestinian leaders criticizing right back at Ariel Sharon's plan to reoccupy large parts of the West Bank, Ari Fleischer announcing that President Bush will hold off on his much-anticipated Mideast peace plan speech after the violence, wildfires in Colorado, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura saying he will not seek re-election on Capitol Hill, debate of the new cabinet-level Office of Homeland Defense, Space Shuttle Endeavor finding a way to get home, and Jack Buck, the great sportscaster who died last week at age 77. Jack Beatty, news all over the world, but Israel just keeps on churning it up.
It does, as well as the incident you mentioned, the bombing in Jerusalem. The cause of Palestinian freedom was advanced by the murder of a mother and three children in a village outside there.
You speak with bitter irony here.
Yeah, and you know, just that point was made with I think similar irony by Palestinian intellectuals who took out, who very brave men who took out and women who took out an ad saying this tactic of killing innocent people is counterproductive. It's tarnishing everything good about our cause, and it has to stop. That's an extraordinary thing.
We had Edward Luttwak on the show earlier this week, and he said, you know, they need this fence. These two peoples have simply not reached the state of relations or maturity as nations to deal with each other. Fence it off. Maybe in 100 years it'll work.
Yeah, you know, you have to think that maybe something like that is that's the shape of the future, that some kind of unilateral withdrawal, a give-in on the settlements, not as part of a deal, but just as a withdrawal, and maybe even, you know, an end to any kind of Palestinian association, and essentially Israel would import laborers from Southeast Asia. They're already doing that, having to do that in some areas.
And yet one can't help thinking that the physical simplicity of a fence is probably ultimately too simple to contain this. People have been waiting for the White House for a long time to show new leadership, and this week again President Bush said, and it's understandable, we can't deliver a new initiative in the midst of this kind of violence. But once again, the U.S. can't get ahead of the curve here.
No, the terrorists control the pace here and shape our response. And, you know, in all candor, the president would want to delay this for as long as he could, because it clearly isn't going to satisfy some of the Arab allies who've talked to him. And he's not going. There's just too many domestic political risks for him to be harder on Israel than probably as hard as it would need to get a swap involving the settlement.
And yet we heard all week Arabs and Israelis saying we need American leadership to get through this. Minnesota is going to have new leadership. Jesse Ventura, we heard his Dracula-style voice there saying he's out, he has to protect his family. What a one-term wonder.
Yeah, Garrison Keillor was calling him Fred. Remember that? Because he said, I don't want the press using my name.
He's back to his boa or calling football, I'm not sure, but I've heard Minnesotans say this was the truck driver's revenge on the hoity-toity of Minnesota. The one time they voted, and they voted in Jesse Ventura.
Yeah, and you know he ran against one of the candidates was Skip Humphrey, the former vice president's son, and Skip and the other guy were so polite that they wouldn't at dinner they wouldn't even interrupt people eating to say vote for me. They were so Minnesotan.
So this was not Jesse Ventura, and soon he'll be gone. And goodbye to Jack Buck. I can remember years ago, Jack Beatty, when my grandparents would listen to St. Louis Cardinals games late at night. I'd be lying in bed a couple rooms down, and it was in those years Harry Carey and Jack Buck, I think.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that from so many people from the Midwest that was part of their going to bed. They could hear that from the down the kitchen.
It was cicadas and the St. Louis Cardinals and Jack Buck.
Who had a great voice and did a lot of football games, too. And we know him up here in New England because he did some Super Bowl games.
Well, off he goes at 77. Jack Beatty, have a great weekend.
And you, too.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.